मनोबुद्ध्यहंकारचिन्तानि नाहं न च श्रोत्रजिह्वेन च घ्राणनेत्रे न च व्योमभूमेन तेजो न वायु चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न च प्राणसंज्ञो न वै पञ्चवायु न वा सप्तधातुर्न वा पञ्चकोशा न वा पाणिपादं न चोपस्थपायु चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न मे द्वेषरागौ लोभमोहौ मदो नैव मे नैव मात्सर्यभाव न धर्मो न चार्थो न कामो न मोक्ष चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न पुण्यं न पापं न सौख्यं न दुःखम् न मन्त्रो न तीर्थं न वेदा न यज्ञा अहं भोजनं नैव भोज्यं न भोक्ता चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं अहं निर्विकल्पो निराकाररूपो विभूत्वाच्च सर्वत्र सर्वेन्द्रियाणां न चासङ्गतं नैव मुक्तेन मे चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप। शिवोहं 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 मनोबुद्ध्यहंकारचेतानि नाहं न च श्रोत्रजिह्वेन च घ्राणनेत्रे न च व्योमभूमिन तेजो न वायु चिदानन्दरूप शिवोहं शिवोहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोहं शिवोहं न च प्राणसंज्ञो न वै पञ्चवायु न वा सप्तधातु न वा पञ्चकोशा न वा पाणिपादं न चोपस्थपायु चिदानन्दरूप शिवोहं शिवोहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोहं शिवोहं न मे द्वेषरागौ न मे लोभमोहौ मदो नैव मे नैव मात्सर्यभाव न धर्मो न चार्थो न कामो न मोक्ष चिदानन्दरूप शिवोहं शिवोहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोहं शिवोहं न पुण्यं न पापं न सौख्यं न दुःखम् न मन्त्रो न तीर्थं न वेदा न यज्ञा अहं भोजनं नैव भोज्यं न भोक्ता चिदानन्दरूप शिवोहं शिवोहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोहं शिवोहं अहं निर्विकल्पो निराकाररूपो विभूत्वाच्च सर्वत्र सर्वेन्द्रियाणां न चासङ्गतं नैव मुक्तेर्न मे चिदानं शिवोहं शिवोहं चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं 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 मनोबुद्ध्यहङ्कारचिन्तानि नाहम् न च श्रोत्रजिह्वेन च घ्राणनेत्रे न च व्योमभूमेन तेजो न वायु चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न च प्राणसंज्ञो न वै पञ्चवायु न वा सप्तधातून वा पञ्चकोशा न वा पाणिपादं न चोपस्थपायु चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न मे द्वेषरागौ न मे लोभमोहौ मदो नैव मे नैव मात्सर्यभाव न धर्मो न चार्थो न कामो न मोक्ष चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप न पुण्यं न पापं न सौख्यं न दुःखं न मन्त्रो न तीर्थं न वेदा न यज्ञा अहं भोजनं नैव भोज्यं न भोक्ता चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं अहं निर्विकल्पो निराकाररूपो विभूत्वाच्च सर्वत्र सर्वेन्द्रियाणां न चासं ಕೃತಂ ನೈವ ಮುಕ್ತೇನ ಮೇಯ ಚಿದಾನಂದ ರೂಪ ಶಿವೋಹಂ ಶಿವೋಹಂ ಚಿದಾನಂದ ರೂಪ ಶಿವೋಹಂ ಶಿವೋಹಂ ಚಿದಾನಂದ ರೂಪ ಶಿವೋಹಂ ಶಿವೋಹಂ ಚಿದಾನಂದ ರೂಪ ಶಿವೋಹಂ 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 ಶಿವೋಹಂ
Hello, and welcome to our Q&A. And I know that there are a lot of questions because people have been sending me emails all day with questions, many of them about the left big toe and the sequence of the practices of meditating on the body. So I will try to clear up any confusion that I might have inadvertently caused. And every other question that comes up. So I'm just going to turn it over to you guys. We're going to do the Q&A the way we do questions on the calls in the regular classes, which is that we're going to ask you to raise your hand, and Deb will call on you. So that way we won't have people asking questions at the same moment. And Deb, do you want to tell us something about the mode?
Nope, I think that works. Do star 2, and if you're on our webcast and have a question, just write that in, and I will post, or I will put that it out there.
Fantastic. So, hello.
Just star 2 if you have a question.
And if nobody has a first question, I will answer a couple of questions that came up in the that I got emails about, and they all have to do, this particular set of questions has to do with the actual specifics of the practice of bringing your attention to the different points in the body, the different elemental points in the body. So the first question was, is the top of the crown under the top of the skull, or is it the space in the cranial bone directly above? And what my answer to that is that it's the space right on top of the skull, like outside the body, or you can do it inside the body, but I find that what's most natural for me, and what tends to open that center, is to actually bring my attention to the top of the skull, right over the fontanelle, and this seems to attract the Shakti to start to rise to that point. The other question that these come from Catherine in Germany, she also asked, is the focus point of the water element the uvula, or a little higher and a little farther back? So the place of the water element is described as being that little hanging knob of flesh. And what I have found is that's right at the top of the larynx, really. I've found in doing this practice that there's a sweet spot that my attention finds. You can't really do it with your hand, obviously, at least not while you're meditating. I guess you can look in the mirror and see it, open your mouth and see it, but you actually can feel it. And it is actually, as she asks, it is it is actually a little bit higher inside the, or at least I find it a little bit higher at the area just above that hanging knob of flesh, and at least that's where I find it with my attention. You know, it's where I feel it kinesthetically. So, and her third question is, are these focus points also chakras, or are they rather doors or gaps? And I believe, you know, that the text doesn't say. These instructions come from a very old tantric text called the Swachanda Tantra, on which I have not found any commentaries. And Kshema Raja quotes it, and Lakshmanju also quotes it, without really commenting. So, but I believe they're considered to be chakras. So, the main thing is that those of you who are practicing with them is that they're actually very open centers of consciousness, which to me were unexpected when I first discovered them, but which have proved quite powerful, especially in centering the body and centering yourself in the body while recognizing the way in which the physical body itself is, you know, really has so many centers that lead to a non-physical place. So now we're open for questions, and I hope that maybe you'd like to be the second question. Raise your hand and be the second
question. We have someone in Vermont.
Okay. Hi.
Yeah. Hi, Sally. The one
is Barry.
Seems to be the one from Vermont. Yes, it is.
Hi.
Hi. So my question revolves around magnetism and repulsion.
Okay.
That,
terrific.
I you liked the beginning so far.
I do, yeah.
I am noticing that instead of magnetizing, I am repulsing. And I don't mean it in the repulsive, you know, oh, you're repulsive. But that as if you had a magnet and you turned it around and it pushes apart. And I see.
So you're going to give an example, right?
I can give you lots of examples.
Okay.
I'll be on an airplane and I have seats empty next to me. I go to a movie theater and nobody sits next to me. I post things on the list and nobody responds to them. I have people who I have a very strong immediate connection to. And then they write to me and they're like, oh, I really like our energy together and I can't do it anymore. I have to go on retreat, or, you know, that just like the energy just totally goes away. Those are examples.
Okay. Well, I'm going to give you,
I sort of want to finish the question. Those are examples.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, okay.
It's okay. And I do want to hear what you have to say. But here's the question.
No, I thought you were done.
Do I embrace that at this point in my evolution, I am at a stage where I am repulsive, and that's okay. That's fine. That's perfect. Or do I ask for help in reversing that?
It's a really good question, and I understand. I think I understand what's going on energetically, because I had the same experience for much of my life, and I have to say honestly that a lot of it was because I was sometimes deliberately, as on a bus, I would say, okay, I would kind of create this energy where I would literally repulse people who wanted to sit down next to me. Didn't always work, of course, if the bus was crowded, But there is an energy that you can kind of put out that it's a little bit like having energetic spikes in your field. And I think people learn how to do this in order, because they're energetically sensitive and they like to keep some space around themselves. I want you to know I've thought about this a lot. You know, I've looked at the way energy magnetizes or repels. I don't think it has much to do with the personality, and especially when it's a normally friendly person. But it has to do with an energetic choice that you made at a certain point in your life, which created a kind of a shell around you. And probably the choice was made for good reasons, you know, that whether it was your family situation or living in a situation where there wasn't a lot of privacy, that you actually, you know, create a privacy zone. And then it can be hard to take it off. You know, you kind of have to deliberately work with the energy and take it off. And I'll tell you how to do that if you want to do it. You feel your way into the energetic contraction, because it is a contraction. It's like a subtle boundary that you've put around yourself. And as I said, that boundary may have sharp edges on it, because that's part of what we do, and we want to make it very clear that we're not up for intimacy at a given moment. We literally create I call them spikes, but they're pointed. It's a pointed form of energy that literally repels. So you could actually imagine those energetic barriers softening and dissolving. And my suggestion is that you do it in situations in which you want to have more of an intimate experience. And you don't do it by putting your energy out and trying to draw people in. You do it by feeling the energy of the part of you that holds people off. And just specifically melting it in that situation. Does that make sense? I mean, it's very hard to describe this in words because it's an energetic thing.
Yes, it
but
is.
I
appreciate the what I would call grasping, the energetic grasping, and how that doesn't work. I've definitely recognized that. It's not that I don't want intimacy. It's that I keep coming up against this. I guess what you're saying is what I haven't seen yet are the spikes, and then to look for them and ask them to be dissolved.
Yeah, and also to recognize that this is a choice you made. In other words, it's not that people, you know, I'm going to be very, you know, just to say it quite graphically, it's not that people are rejecting you or that they don't like you. It's
I don't see that either.
Yeah, so you just want to demolish, or in other words, give yourself the choice to demolish the boundary without grasping, and also without losing yourself. Because usually when we put up boundaries like that, it's because our energetic field is fairly porous or open, and there's a natural desire to protect ourselves from it, having it impinged on by energies that we're not comfortable with. So, and again, in my personal experience, and I've seen it with kids I know, that when somebody is extremely energetically sensitive, school can be very energetically challenging. So a lot of the behavior that kids put out that seems off-putting or unfriendly or aggressive, even aggressive, is often a way of just kind of unconsciously protecting the edges of a vulnerable energetic field. So I think we you know, we make those decisions at age 5 or 6 or, you know, 9 or 10, and then it's in place, right? Mm-hmm. So it you know, we need to make that we then need to make a different choice when we want to be more open.
All right.
Thank you for that question. It's a question that's rarely asked, and I think it's a very big factor in our lives. That, you know, those ways of holding energy.
And thank you for receiving the question.
Oh.
And putting wisdom upon it.
Yeah. Okay, darling.
We have a question that came off the webcast.
Okay.
Jane asks, why is the water element associated with the uvula?
Don't ask me. I have no idea. I mean, honestly, when I'm in this particular class, one of the things I'm trying to make you cognizant of and work with is these esoteric practices that are such a part of the Anava Upaya approach to Tantra. And, you know, and if you've studied the Vijnana Bhairava, you know that there are quite a few practices that there's sort of no explanation of why we're doing it. But I'll tell you my hit about the water element and the uvula is it's that it has to do with saliva. You know, that especially in a place like India, which is very dry and very dusty, one of the effects of being in an extremely dry climate and also when we're when the Shakti's rising, when Kundalini is rising, which, you know, all of these tantric practices are very much concerned with, there's a tendency for the body to dry up. And I believe that this point in that throat is actually a trigger point for the flow of saliva, which is the most immediate way that we bring the water element into our, you know, our physical and emotional consciousness. It really is through activating the saliva. So I believe that's one reason why that is the case. But I've never found a trustworthy scriptural authority for you know why the water element is in that particular spot. But I will say that I've been doing this practice for a few months, and I've noticed that it's actually very good for dryness in the throat, dryness in the mouth, and even dryness in the eyes. So it works.
We have another question from the webcast. Sarona asks, in previous seminars, we have used Om Hrim Shrim, and in this seminar, the mantra is Om Shrim Hrim. Is there a significant difference to the use of the mantra?
The Om Hrim Shrim is a sequence that goes with the goddess Lalita. Om Shrim Hrim is usually associated with the goddess Lakshmi. And I want to say one thing about these Bij mantra sequences. As you probably know, if you've practiced with different teachers, that every deity has not just one Bij sequence that's connected to them. Usually, especially the goddesses, usually there are 3 or 4 or 5 or 6. So, you know, you can invoke Lakshmi with Om Shrim Hrim. I've also heard her invoked with Om Hrim Shrim. The reason I do it like this is because after a long discussion with my friend Constantina Rhodes, who's a Lakshmi scholar, we decided that this was probably the most accurate way to do the Lakshmi Bij mantras, and I'll tell you why. Shrim is the mantra for Lakshmi. You know, it's the bij that is most associated with Lakshmi. The mantra Hrim, which is a profound and deep mantra with lots of meanings and lots of uses, and of course, as many of you know, it's associated with the goddess Bhuvaneshwari, it's associated with the goddess Lalita, and it's considered to be it's called the Devi Pranava, which is to say it's the goddess equivalent of the mantra Om. And one of its characteristics, so in that sense, it's a deep mantra for meditation. And in traditions where you're given a bij mantra as your meditation focus, it's often given as an advanced mantra. So after you've done a lot of practice, your guru will give you Hrim as your next step practice. After the mind has been quite purified, there is another meaning and, let's say, significant use of Hrim. Hrim has the quality of spreading the Shakti, of making the Shakti, which you know might be contracted or might be kind of localized. Hrim widens it, broadens it, makes it expand. So in the case of this Lakshmi mantra, we begin with Om. Of course, almost all bij sequences begin with Om, but we first invoke Shrim, indicating that it's Lakshmi that we're invoking, and then Hrim, which is of course the ultimate goddess bij mantra, then serves to expand the energy of Shrim, the energy of the auspicious goddess. So that's why we're doing it that way, and it seems to be, according to Constantina, the agreed upon, you know, most, quote, correct. Though, again, as you may have noticed, there's so many tantric lineages, and many of them consider one version correct that a different lineage thinks is incorrect. But this particular mantra, I've gotten into the habit of doing this way. And my question to you, it would be, how does it feel when you do it? So that, you know, that would be the question I would suggest you you look at as you're considering what the mantra is, what effect the mantra has on you. It's empowered, you know, it's been shaktified, so I've given it to you with an empowerment. And so you can kind of allow it to show you what it is in the course of practice. So again, good question.
Okay, we've got a question from Karen.
Okay, hi Karen.
Hi Sally, can you hear me?
Yep.
Oh, wonderful. Well, I'm loving this class. And I actually have two questions. I think they're just kind of subtle nuance type questions. And the first one is, these practices are making me want to be talking very softly, which in my family, we don't do. We're not Italian, but I'm telling you, we are loud. And my students, I have students, they can be boisterous I just want to start talking soft. I'm thinking to myself, I don't know how to be soft, talk soft from that place that we just opened up inside us, right? And hold that when I'm around, you know, in a week, I'm going to have 20 people in my house, all of them loud and boisterous, and my students, anyway, I'm wondering if you had any advice for me to help me learn how to, because, or is the wisdom to just match them, to just go back into that loudness?
Well, I think
it's a weird question, isn't it?
No, it's not a weird question. It, first of all, what's happening is that you're becoming more internal, you know, as I imagine you figured out. So your consciousness is interiorized, and especially when you're doing a lot of meditation, and the kind of meditation that we've been doing, which actually, you know, these meditations ask us to get very granular about these different, you know, these different centers in the inner body. And that means that our awareness is constantly interiorizing, like really turning back, turning in, trying to feel into the energy of the central channel, or feel into the energy of these points in the body, or, you know, feel into the experience that we're invoking in these rather technical inner body practices. And one of the effects of that is to just make all your senses more internal. So it seems very natural to me that your voice would get quieter. And I guess the question is, do you want to make yourself heard in a room full of people talking? Because, you know, characteristically, if you live with a noisy family, a very talkative family, and you're speaking quietly, nobody's going to pay attention to what you're saying, right?
That's actually a great question, because maybe that is a great question. And I don't need to be heard. I really don't. It's just I get caught up in everybody else are talking loud, so the person I'm talking to is talking loud, so I feel I have to talk loud to be physically heard as opposed to,
right,
you know, energetically heard. So I don't know. You talk soft. When you're in a loud room, do people still hear you?
People characteristically never hear a word I say if I'm in a group talking in my normal voice. In order to make myself heard in a group, I have to just make up my mind that I want to be heard and be a little bit aggressive and louder than I normally am. So I can tell you from experience that if you're talking in a soft voice with a bunch of noisy people, they will ignore you. That's actually okay in certain moments, you know.
Yeah.
But it's not always okay. So we have choices, which we don't always take advantage of the fact that you can make a decision. Okay, in this situation, I'm going to go against my natural instinct and talk loud. And if it makes, and this is the important piece of this advice, that if you start to feel that it's uncomfortable for you to project, then take your attention inward, take it into the heart or take it into the back body, and see what happens when you speak from that place. Because my hit is that if you're a naturally more introverted person and you've been brought up in a situation and you work in a situation where there's a lot of interaction, that you've had to train yourself to speak up, you know, and that because this practice is cultivating interiorization, you may be realizing that actually you're much more of an internal and soft voice person than an extroverted loud person, and that means you're going to have to kind of calibrate. So, you know, because you don't necessarily want to be ignored in your family gatherings, right? And one thing that I've learned, you know, because I my family are, as some of you may have noticed from talking to me, in my family we all tend to interrupt each other and talk over each other. So in order to get a word in edgewise with my brothers, I have to tell them to shut up. you can do that. You can just say, hey.
Well, thank you for picking up on the what I was asking. You've answered my question, and I really appreciate that. Do I have time to ask you one other one? I think it's a quick question.
Sure.
And it relates to your giving us this I've never done this before, just when the thoughts come in big, you know, to go drop it, to just use this phrase, drop it. And I've been doing that. And there's such a different energy on it. It feels more command. It's like I'm in command here. And I wondered, is that how you meant us to use it, or should I be using it more softly?
Yeah.
But it's like, it's not, most of my other techniques, you know, for watching the thoughts are softer. It's to just neutralize them, let them pass, those kinds of things. But to literally look at it and say, drop it.
Should I be staying away from Stern?
I guess. Okay, it is.
Well, find a voice that doesn't make you feel contracted. I just listened to a podcast that someone I know does, in which he's talking about the evolutionary process and how it shows up in different, you know, the socially motivated evolutionary process. And he was talking about Judge Judy, which Americans are probably aware of Judge Judy. She's not so known in other parts of the world, but she's a daytime program, you know, kind of same time as, she's on daytime TV, and it's a situation in which it's a court. People come to court, they argue their case. It's like small claims court. And then she settles the case, and the way she does it is by yelling at them. She says, how can you think that it's okay to get out of your car and show your road rage to this person who's suing you? I mean, what kind of stupid behavior is that? She's very commanding, and she's very skillful. I mean, I wouldn't particularly want to be in a courtroom with Judge Judy. She feels kind of mean. But you see the people get the point, you know, like just stop being stupid and shut up is sometimes something that we have to say to our mind, because, you know, our minds are will do anything that we let them get away with. So, yeah, it's a very useful practice, and it may not be the practice that you want to use for mind control all the time, but when your mind is really going bananas, and you can say, okay, drop it, drop it, drop it, you can very quickly get to stillness. It's quite an efficient practice.
It's extremely efficient. So thank you. That was the nuance I was looking for, was, you know, is it okay to be commanding, you know? Not
mean,
be
commanding.
But...
be commanding.
Okay.
You know, you're in charge of your mind. Don't let your mind run you around.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Sally. Appreciate you taking the questions.
My pleasure.
Okay.
I just unmuted Vivi. I think it is in Greece.
Hi, Vivi.
Hi, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Oh, lovely. So nice to be close to Sally and Deb and the whole international Sangha.
So nice to have you here.
Thank you. Sally, you mentioned in the class about reaching a point in our meditation that feels like a glass ceiling, like you're there and you feel that there's something beyond, but you cannot go further. And for me, it seems like I'm kind of like in that place in my meditation for years now. So what can you tell us about that? Like, what's the skillful way to practice with that?
Great question, and I think it's not unusual, to put it mildly. So, leaving aside the explanation for why this happens, the practice that, if you remember, I discussed was the practice of actually letting yourself be present with the block or with the feeling of the wall, and recognizing the wall as Shakti. And you know, my experience with looking at your own consciousness, and I'm using the word in its individual meaning, your own chitta, you know, the the manifestations of mind energy that we experience, which, as you know, we're normally so identified with our mind that we forget what the mind is, which, you know, and again, as you know, Vivi, the mind is, you know, it's a field of infinitely shifting energies, aspects of consciousness. And the trick in that Tantra gives us is to look directly or feel directly into the energy of the field rather than either identifying with it or looking at it as a substance, as something fixed, which is what we tend to do with obstructive energies or emotions. So there are lots of different tactics for working with obstructive energies, one of which is what we were just talking about, that, you know, to tell our thoughts, drop it. You can't do that with an energetic block. It's basically too powerful. And also, most of the energetic blocks that we experience in meditation are there for a reason. You know, often it's because we had an energetic opening that was too much and got scared and sort of shut it down. And Shakti is very responsive in that respect. So, you know, what I shared with you was a practice that I actually learned from a friend of mine who's very skillful at working with mind energies. And the practice is that you feel into this sense of blockage or this sense of wall, and then you honor it. You know, you speak to it, you say something, these are his words, what he said was, "O infinite wall, I honor your presence. Please allow me to be fully present with you in an open way and do whatever you do, but know that I recognize you as a form of the divine Shakti." And he got himself into a kind of a devotional, loving connection to his own, you know, obstructive mind energy. And in that particular moment, it dissolved and his whole meditation opened. Now, that basic approach, recognize and love it, essentially, is, I find, very skillful with pretty much any obstructive emotion that you come to in meditation. There's another approach which is in my book. It's in the first chapter of my book, and I describe it as a practice that I learned to do in precisely these circumstances. I've taught it sometimes, so you may know it. It's where you sit and you feel the wall, you feel the space in your mind consciousness that feels like it's closed. In other words, that sense of block, and you imagine an opening in the energy, like a window or a door, and then you literally take your attention through it, as though not your body, which is, you know, the thing we have to learn how to do, but just like leap through the hole. Let your attention leap through the hole, and then let yourself begin to flow in the field of Shakti, which will reveal itself as you come through it. And that field of Shakti is actually the subtler reaches of your own mind. And as you keep allowing yourself to travel through it, so to speak, to move through it, have the feeling that as you move through that space, you're actually becoming the space. So it's not me moving through my consciousness. It's me becoming this layer of my awareness, becoming the next subtler layer. And it's like swimming in the consciousness field of your own mind. And what happens is that it just it's becomes subtler and subtler as you keep moving, and you more and more begin to experience the really largeness of your own mind field. And this is the essence of Shakta Upaya practice. So I play with that. And there is a description of it in chapter 1 of Meditation for the Love of It. It seems a little counterintuitive, but it's quite powerful.
Yeah, thank you. That's more like a gentle, active way to go with it. And my approach is like kind of like, do you know the book Waiting for Godot?
Right.
So my approach was, because I had heard that advice to just relax with it. And so I'm just like relaxing and waiting and relaxing and waiting and relaxing and waiting. And it is like waiting for Godot. So this is helpful, what you're describing. And I referred to the book again, and I think that it will make sense instinctually, and something will start flowing. The energy of my meditation. So
yeah.
I hope it works.
Well, you know, Vivi, you're kind of an activist person by nature. So I think, you know, doing a little activism in your meditation will help you kind of break through. And then you could go back to, you know, the more passive method, which of course is very skillful in its own way in certain moments. But when we feel stuck, there's a real skill in experimenting with the energy, not with the idea of making something happen, but just with the idea of really, finding a different route. Because, as you know, any meditation that we do constantly without experimenting with it will often kind of reify, you know, make our consciousness kind of into an object. And what we have to do is break through that. Allow ourselves to really, really experience the infinite creativity of our own mind as an expression of Shakti. And this is kind of a cool way to do that.
It sounds exciting.
Yeah, it's fun. So play with it and let me know how it works.
Thank you. Thank you so
much. You're
welcome. Thank
you.
You're
so welcome. Okay,
we have someone in California, I believe.
Okay.
This is Lakshmi.
Hi, Lakshmi.
Hi. So no more fires, I'm happy to report.
Good, I'm really glad.
So I have a question, which is, I guess, kind of related to protocol. I find myself very naturally wanting to kind of go into the field without needing a lot of preparatory visualizations. And I just wanted to ask, you know, because I also realize that there's a skillfulness and a reason it's not just the doorway. But I wanted to ask about, you know, if I'm kind of inclined to just start melting even before I'm, you know, going to do one of the central channel practices, how to be with that, I suppose.
So let me get clear. Are you saying that your inclination is just to be present with the practice, or is it just to go right directly into the central channel?
So, to be present with the different practices that you're giving us, you know, with or without the mantra, the move in the prana, or moving the energy. And sometimes as soon as I start to sit, I'm feeling the pull to just kind of
let
dissolve
go
rather than, yeah.
Yeah, Well, okay, so I think that's fine. And here's my question, and this is one of the reasons why I got interested in playing with Anava Upaya practices. You know, we get into a way of meditating where the Shakti rises and kind of takes us into an inner state. And, you know, and we learn that if we sit there long enough, that state will expand. And this is perfect. It's good meditation. One of the reasons why I have found it so helpful to actually do a concentrative practice, whether it's the space between the breaths or, you know, mantras in the three centers in the central channel or one of these more esoteric practices, is because there during the times in our practice and in our life when we're super busy or our mind is very distracted or, you know, we just keep getting thrown out of our meditative state, when we start to feel that our meditation is not really meditation, it's kind of sleepy, you know, which can happen when we're letting ourselves melt sometimes. It's a strategy for using your power of concentration to take you into a more awake and more deliberate state. And I know I first started doing Anava Upaya practices 2 or 3 years ago after a long period of meditating on awareness, just sitting in awareness. And I noticed that it was starting to get dull and it was starting to get routinized. So I started to play. And I noticed that there were certain practices that really kindled Shakti. For me, the central channel practice is one of the main ones, but maybe the main one, but, you know, there are others as well. So I see them as very skillful, so to speak, tools in your practice arsenal. And therefore, they're worth learning. And it's worth discovering the ones that have a, you know, a spark for you, and that you don't need to have more than 1 or 2 or 3, but there are going to be times when it's very helpful to draw on them. And yes, of course, if you can just melt into meditation and that meditation feels awake and restful, you know, and is taking you deeper into the madhya, then that's completely fine, and that's where you'll end up anyway. But if you're having a hard time settling, the Anava Upaya practices are incredibly helpful.
Okay, that's very useful on a practical level, because there's times where it feels like the practice becomes a little bit of labor, and even as much as I'm trying to kind of have the practice happen and not be the doer of the practice, there's times where it feels like more effort to maintain the practice than to just kind of get into be in a meditative state.
Yeah, and it is effort to do a concentrative practice. So, you know, and it's not always necessary. But it's nice to be able to do it when it's helpful. So
I wasn't sure if the specifics are, you know, they're related to just, I don't know, some of the subtle naughties, or if it's good to be, you know, clearing certain energy with those practices as opposed to just, you know.
I will say this. These practices do clear the nadis. You know, I mean, they have a yogic purpose, every one of them. And and if you're doing a kind of meditation where, you know, if you're taking a yogic approach to meditation where, you know, you're, for instance, if you're wanting to activate Kundalini in the central channel, or if you're wanting to open one of the chakras, or work with an energetic block, these practices, many of these practices are specifically designed to do that. So, so they'll, you know, you can work with, as you know, I'm sure, you can work with breath and the chakras and the centers and the central channel, and, you know, very skillfully to dispel blocks. And that's, you know, that's part of what Anavatapaya practice is about. It's about, there, you know, these practices are about clearing your inner field so that the ever-existent, the, you know, the ever-present Shakti can be revealed, can be, you know, can move freely. But that said, she will do it herself. If you, you know, if it, it's just that it usually takes more time. And I, what I would say this is extremely, it's extremely important to chant, to do invocational mantras, to tune into the Shakti who is running your meditation just in a devotional way for a couple of minutes, which is part of what
the central
because so that
I mean
now,
that
I
I'm
say,
doing regardless.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, great. So you're good.
Okay, that's
you're
helpful.
Good.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I love all these technical questions. It's also okay to pretty much ask anything regarding your practice.
Okay. I just unmuted somebody from Oregon.
Okay.
I think it might be Wendy.
Hi, Sally. Yeah, it
Hi.
Is Wendy. Hi, Sally.
Hi,
How
Wendy.
Are you?
I'm
yeah.
good. How are you, sweetie?
Oh, it's been hard lately. So, yeah, I actually would love for you to talk a little bit more about what you wrote me in that note about contractions and, you know, this opening space. That's kind of the thing that's struck me most deeply in this course, because I just can't quite follow the technical stuff right now. So the you know, and partly like I wrote to you earlier today, like I'm so desperately trying to maintain this space. And so I also don't want to become like dogmatic, you know, but like this Swami gave me this practice. And so I'm just kind of devoted to the idea of that practice because I had this massive relief and
right.
opening that made me
right.
believe that I could have life again. And it was really such an exquisite experience, you know, like where I really, really understood how blessed this life is. When you, like, it's not even a thought. It's just your whole, like, somebody just wrote today about that idea of freedom, you know, where
right.
it's just, it's like just so palpable. You can't believe that you didn't know it was there all along.
Right.
And then, like, I thought it was so, like, real and there that I would never lose it again. Like, that's so naive, you know, that I thought, okay, this is healed now. But I just didn't, like, get, which is so strange because, of course, I've seen a million times how this kind of opens and closes. But, you know, the experience was so miraculous, was so transformative
yeah.
that I thought it was like done, you know, which is like sounds silly even as I'm saying it to you, but
no, it doesn't. And I understand what you mean, and I'll tell you what I believe happened. There was a healing, and you still have the samskaras that have to be cleared. You know, it's like clearly, when we have an experience like that, when we have a big opening like that, it really affects the whole system, but it affects the energy. But it doesn't mean that we don't need to continue practicing. And I'll tell you honestly, a lot of you know, when you're in a holy place and in a situation like you experienced with this Swami, there's a kind of a magic and a mystique that has to do with the place. And, you know,
well,
and
also the person, I mean.
And the
he
person,
was really
yeah.
magical
I'm sure,
also.
Well, that, yeah. And fantastic. That's fantastic. And, you know, and it's real, and it's not to say that it won't survive in, you know, in Eugene, Oregon in the same way is not to deny the power of the experience. But it did, you know, the thing about initiations, the thing about awakenings, when they come directly from a person, is that there's a way in which they are to some extent to have the fullness of the experience partly depends on being with that person. And this is why people get addicted to teachers, because the way they feel in the presence of the teacher is different mm-hmm. than the way they feel at home. So, and that's just a fact, right? So you're not going to spend your life with this Swami. I mean, at least it doesn't look like it right now. And I will say that if you were to decide you wanted to spend a lot of time with him, it would have its ups and downs, you know, as,
right,
you know, as everything does. So I would say, you know, thank you.
No, I mean, what I want most is to know how to find that altar in myself, you know, to like keep, you know, like I said, you know, like remembering the truth of that, to keep remembering sort
well,
of the,
darling,
the blessings
this was
of this life.
Yeah, I get it. I totally get it. But you can't do it through recalling an experience.
Yeah.
In other words, you know that. It's like when we have a great experience, a great meditation or a great opening, it's very beautiful to recall it, to remember it, and sometimes remembering it can bring the feeling up, but you can't recreate it, you know, because it's in the past, and yourself is in the present, and it's to be in the self in an active, alive way is right now. And,
yeah.
You know, and if you're trying to do it through remembering something that happened 3 weeks ago, you're not in the now. I mean, I know you know this. This is non-duality 101. But we always forget it because the mind, you know, always thinks that there's some, you know, that great moment, you know, with that great conversation, that great taste, that great experience, if only we could have that, then, you know, then we'd be in that place again. But there's a new version of it that's going to emerge. And, you know, your home, you're in your life, which is always, you know, a hotbed of samskaras and vasanas and old patterns. So
yeah, like in my family right now, oh my God.
Yeah, so I know. So Yeah.
So painful.
So right now, ask yourself, where's the sweetness in your heart? You know, if you turn your awareness into your heart and just ask, where's the sweetness? Not in a way of, God damn it, where's the sweetness? Or, you know, please show me the sweetness, but just, you know, the way you ask a pure self-inquiry question, the sweetness is there.
Yeah.
And just ask and notice the little softening. It may be very little that it rises. And without clinging to it, just let yourself recognize, okay, moment by moment by moment, I can tune into the sweetness in my heart, and that's what we need to do when we're walking through our life and things are challenging, is be willing to recognize the incredible power of these moments that you can kindle by being very, very authentically present to your own heart, to your own being.
Yeah.
You know, it's it's not necessarily the ecstatic opening that you find at a holy place with a holy person.
It was like the fact that I came from that and I came home and I felt like I had myself again. I found myself again.
When
you know,
did you
like
do have
in
yourself?
That, in that brief, but I hadn't felt like that all this last time. You know, like I felt like so much of myself had like disappeared and then like suddenly like my heart wasn't just a shattered mess. It was like connected to this deep, deep heart of the universe.
Well,
like
I'm going to be real. I'm going to be really straight with you, okay?
Yeah.
What you've done is taken yourself back into the contracted state.
Yeah.
By mourning the disappearance of something, and it, you know, your heart is open. Your being is open. You know, this, he did dispel it. And, you know, and you, it's like you're doing this.
I mean, I don't know if
with,
it was him or it was like this whole ritual thing that they do there and all that.
Darling, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. India is a magical place. We have experiences in India that are kind of part of the, you know, the glorious tradition that's in so many places in India. And, you know, if you're, first of all, you can make an altar that will give you that experience in a physical place. But it's really about not believing what your mind tells you, not believing the story that I hear you telling yourself about, you know, I thought I had it, but it turns out I don't. You have it. And it's just your mind that's telling you don't. And I really, really want you to remember that.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's your mind that's making you believe that there's something that you know, that you've lost that you won't get back. You haven't lost it. You've had a hard, hard experience, and but you haven't lost it.
Yeah.
So just.
I mean, this is the whole thing about this teaching, about the contraction and the opening, and I mean, mine is more intense, but I don't think so. It's the same for everybody.
It's human. It's human. But, you know, we compound it by owning it. And, you know, and this is for everybody, there's this vibrant place that is the emotional madhya, you know, the emotional midpoint, where you're not in denial about pain and discomfort. You're not pretending everything is okay and ignoring, you know, the energies that you might need to deal with. But you're also not believing the despairing story that the mind starts to tell us when things aren't great. And that's true when we're in physical pain. It's true when we're in emotional pain. It's true when we're in, you know, in our family situations, which are so challenging for so many of us so much of the time. It's like, yes, difficult. Yes. You know, difficult needs to be acknowledged. No, doesn't need to be dwelt in. But the madhya, the inner place, is a place where you just go back into the heart. You go back into your inner body. You go back into the sushumna nadi. You breathe and you allow the ideas about the despairing ideas to just let go right now, and then 5 minutes from now, and 5 minutes from now, and that is sadhana. That really is, that's sadhana. And at some point, you just notice, oh, okay, it's way better than it was. And, oh, now I'm in a different place.
Yeah.
So you know, you have
thank
it.
You.
Yeah, you're so welcome. And it'll be okay, Wendy. And again, yeah, this is for all of us. It'll be okay. It'll be okay.
Yes.
She's yes. holding you, and she's holding every yeah. one of us. So
yeah.
we just, you know, we just need to remember our part is to, you know, to just keep coming back to the mudra, to coming back to the heart, coming back to the central channel, coming back to the mantra, coming back to the breath.
Mm-hmm.
And looking at the contraction, not as a sign that something terrible has happened, but as a pointer, as a reminder, okay, time to get back to the mudra.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
yeah, that's really
you know
helpful.
That.
Yeah. Yeah, that was helpful. Thank you.
You
I
are
mean,
so
I've
welcome.
Really, I've been really relying on the mantras so much. Just like,
yeah.
just going there just all the time. Pretty much all the time. That's what I try to do. So
yes, and
yeah,
yes, yes.
All right. Well, listen, I love you dearly, Sally. Thank you.
Love you too,
so
sweetheart.
And it's always nice to be in this incredible sangha around you. So thanks.
You yes, and yes, it's great. It's great to have you in the sangha as well. So we are at our end point because this is an hour session, but let's just take a moment to come back to the mudra, to come to the breath and the gentle movement of the breath, and bring your attention into the center, into the center of the body or the center of the heart, whichever is most accessible to you at this moment. And with it, having the feeling that you're poised on the inside of the inside, open your pores and let the breath and the Shakti that we are part of in this satsang, just let the particles of prana in the air flow into your body through your pores as though you're breathing through the pores. And let all those parts of your attention that have gotten caught up in the conversations we've been having, let them melt. And feel that with every breath that flows in through your pores, the Shakti opens your being a little bit more. And with that feeling of allowing your body to open to the presence of the prana shakti, that form of the primordial energy which keeps everything alive, in this moment, have the recognition of the grace that is flowing through your life. And in that recognition, we'll chant Om 3 times. And I'm going to chant in a very soft voice so that hear your own internal chanting. Om. 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 Thank you so much for being here. See you on Tuesday. So much love. Thank you, Deb, and thank you, everybody. Namaste. Big love.
मनोबुद्ध्यहंकारचिन्तानि नाहि न च श्रोत जिह्वे न च घ्राणनेत्रे न च व्योमभूमि न तेजो न वायु चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न च प्राणसंज्ञो न वै पञ्चवायु न वा सप्तधातु न वा पञ्चकोशा न वा पाणिपादं न चोपस्थपायु चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न मे द्वेषरागौ लोभमोहौ मदो नैव मे नैव मात्सर्यभाव न धर्मो न चार्थो न कामो न मोक्ष चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न पुण्यं न पापं न सौख्यं न दुःखम् न मन्त्रो न तीर्थं न वेदा न यज्ञा अहं भोजनं नैव भोज्यं न भोक्ता चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं अहं निर्विकल्पो निराकाररूपो चासंगतम नैव मुक्तेन मे चिदानंद रूपा शिवोहं शिवोहं चिदानंद रूपा शिवोहं शिवोहं चिदानंद रूपा शिवोहं शिवोहं चिदानंद रूपा शिवोहं 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 शिवोहं